All right, we're back from break. It is approximately 4 o'clock. Sir, I was wondering, by the time you left from your first tour, what was your feeling, what were your thoughts about the United States effort overall, and whether or not you thought we were accomplishing our missions, our goals, and how successful did you think the policy was up to that point?
I guess by the time I left on the first tour, I had doubts of our ultimate success, even though we had dealt the Viet Cong this tremendous blow. Going back to what Bernard Fall had told us and what we'd read and learned about the effort in Singapore and Malaysia, I didn't think that we were doing what we said we were going to do about winning the hearts and minds of the people, and it looked to me like we were getting to a more ever-increasing American military presence and driven activity, as opposed to an internal Vietnamese driven activity to make their country free of insurgents and whatever. I was disturbed, I guess, personally, because I read, sitting around the headquarters there in Saigon, I got hold of messages that were going out back to the States and giving the status of things, and some of them appeared to be, to me, not as maybe forthright and truthful as they could have been. Maybe they weren't lies, but maybe the whole truth hadn't been laid on the line as well as one might have expected a military man to have done it. And I think a lot of that may have been triggered by our own internal system in the Army. We, you know, you got to look good in order to move up. And McNamara had come up with some sector advisory report where your improvement this month, you know, you did 10 med caps and 10% of your province was under control of the population and et cetera, et cetera. And, it had to improve every month while you were an advisor, or perhaps you weren't doing your job, and they were all just sort of pie-in-the-sky answers because, there was no way of really checking or doing anything. So people tended to inflate these things, I felt. Mm-hmm. And one time, as an example, I remember seeing at our province team, they had a map that had green and yellow and red on it. Red was Viet Cong and green was controlled by the good folks, and yellow was in between. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing this one area that was green, which was way out beyond the top Mui Canal. And I asked the guy at province why that was green. And he said, well, there have been no incidents reported in there in over a year. And I said, there hadn't been a friendly soldier in the area in over a year that I knew of. So who would have reported anything? And that was kind of the concept. So we painted this green. Now we got 20% of the province's green. But in reality, it was pure red. I mean, because nobody would go out there. I mean, it was, that was that kind of a thing. And so I began to really doubt our reporting system and what was going on.
Was this part of HESS, the Hamlet Evaluation System? Or
yeah, it was the Hamlet Evaluation and the Province Evaluation, and this was the G2 officer I was talking to, and saying this is the enemy situation. This is green because there's no incidents. Well, it won't be any until somebody goes out there. Nobody was going out there because it was way out at the end next to the Cambodian border, and it was just nobody going out there. There was no, it was only a couple of little hamlets out there anyway, and no friendlies were going out there. So, as an that was an example of what I mean. That I just begin to wonder whether we were really misleading ourselves sometimes. Our own system did it to us. But I wasn't convinced that we were, you know, we were getting ahead of the game. There was a siege mentality. All the province chiefs had their own little security guards around them, and I, in this job in Saigon, I'd flown out from Saigon to look at in-place training to see if these battalions were coming back and doing this training while they were, and I'd seen Ban Mui Tut, which was blown to hell during Tet, and seen Pleiku, which had suffered during Tet, and I got the serious impression that though we might have won those battles, that we were a lot further from winning the war than we thought we were before.
Mm-hmm. Now, at any point during your year, your first year there, did your opinion at all change about the nature of the war in Vietnam? In that, you mentioned earlier that, of course, the purpose behind the U.S. involvement was to protect South Vietnam from this northern-controlled partisan insurgency in the South. Did that opinion change at all? I mean, how much control did the North have while you were there that you could estimate?
I, from a personal standpoint, I couldn't ascertain the control, but I knew that after Tet, the North had a tremendous impact because of all the weaponry we were getting now was new, modern, automatic, as opposed to what it was before. It was whatever was left over they could scrounge up from the French period or the whatever period it was. But it was older stuff, and now they were modernly resupplied. So I thought it had taken a quantum leap forward as far as the supply of the people in the South. And but up to this time, I'd never seen an NVA. I'd never seen an NVA soldier. So I, whether they were there or not, other than somebody telling me they were, I didn't know it personally. But I had an impression that the system of supply in the South had leaped from zero to a one hell of a good resupply system.
Mm-hmm. And how about your in your conversations with your counterparts and with other advisors? Was there ever any discussion about that issue of how much there was really control from the North versus how much was just internal strife, that kind of stuff?
Well, I think everybody believed at that time, and in talking to people, that the war had taken a dramatic leap forward in Tet, and that there was a lot of, we had a lot of problems, and the middle, I mean, as far as winning this war, we had now a hell of a lot of problems. From a small man's standpoint, I don't know what the big people thought. I read what they said a lot of times, and it didn't. But we didn't think that. We thought that the problems had just were about out of hand. I think, as most of the advisors that I talked to at that time, things were just, you know, things were not good.
When you left, did you think we're going to win?
When I left the first time, I don't think that I... Well, I had envisioned coming back, so I didn't think we were going to...
Okay.
Don't know. I knew I was coming back. I just... So there was no light at the end of the tunnel as far as I could see. This was going to be a long haul thing, and I didn't think we were going to lose or win either one. I just, it's going to be a long haul.
Yeah. So you left in May of 68.
Yeah.
And what was the trip like back, and how were you received when you got back to the United States?
I flew back to Travis Air Base, and my wife picked me up there. Drove me to drove home, or drove to the place where we were going to live, or she was living, or we were living. And I didn't have any reception one way or the other. But my assignment was to the Alameda, California recruiting main station. And we recruited everything in Northern California from Bakersfield to the Oregon border and all of Western Nevada except Las Vegas, which included University of Berkeley, mm-hmm. University of California, Berkeley, Stanford University, and some of those finer schools, Western. And that's why at lunch I mentioned how I was just mm-hmm. doing during that session. And that's when I began to, because this was after Ted of 68. And this is June of 68, I'm going on recruiting duty, trying to go to university to recruit people to go into the Army officer candidate program or warrant officer flight school program and the Army Nurse Corps program and the big city schools were not receptive to this military BS that we were running in South Vietnam. Not at all.
What kind of...
Now, we didn't have a bit of problem in Humboldt State University and up in Eureka, California. They were a small town, lumber town, and nor did we have out of Reno in the western Nevada area. We had good recruiting, but in the big city areas, San Francisco, Oakland, and it was bad news.
What would happen when you go to those places, like Berkeley?
Well, people would heckle you and hackle you, and spray paint your recruiting sedans, and pour sand in your gas tanks. And the Army recruiters that worked in Berkeley walked to work in civilian clothes and put on the uniform after they got to the office. The recruiting station we had in Palo Alto, California, which is right outside of Stanford, they used to throw a brick through the window every time we put a new window in. And the owner of the building evicted us as undesirable to tenants because he got tired of replacing the bricks in his window. And the insurance company said, hey, we ain't going to do it anymore. If you keep the recruiters in there, you're going to have to pay for your own windows. So he evicted us. And it was a bad scene. The university climate was, the only time a university student would talk to you is with a draft notice in one hand, trying to find a way out of getting drafted into the infantry. And that's practically the only way a university student in the metropolitan area of the Bay Area would talk to you. Now, he had a draft notice, they're going to draft him in the Army, and he was going to become an infantryman. He was interested in enlisting in the Army to go to some tech school and quartermaster or anything other than infantry. And that's the way it was. And recruiting got worse. President Nixon decided that we were going to solve we're going to solve some of the problems in society. And we had Project 200,000, which required us to recruit only out of the, I'll call them ghettos for lack of a geographical area of the downtown Oakland and downtown San Francisco that were poverty stricken. And we recruit out of those areas, and we get a recruit, and then we'd have to go try to get a waiver to get him into the service because he had a rap sheet that went from there to there. And the recruiting duty just became a nightmare because you're required to get these people out of these districts. And they had to be minorities and they had to live in these geographical boundaries. And everyone that lived within those geographical boundaries and that didn't have a job had a rap sheet that long, what did he have? Well, joyriding 5 times and grand theft auto 6 times and armed robbery and so, but he was the only guy that would come in and apply, so you just filled out the And some of them got approved. Sometimes they wouldn't, you know, get approved for a waiver, depending on how, you know, how bad his rap sheet was. But it was ridiculous. The Army nurse program, we had good success with it, but it paid for all our education.
Okay.
Worn off the flight training, everybody wanted to fly a helicopter. That's no problem. From there on, it just went downhill. I mean, as far as trying to get somebody to go in. Yeah. And about the time we started going to all-volunteer, we started talking about an all-volunteer Army. We didn't go there then, but we started talking about it. And the upped quotas about how many people we were supposed to get. And recruiters were just going crazy trying to get the quantities. And in order to get the quantity they wanted, they had to go down on quality. So it was not a good scene. I didn't enjoy it at all. Could have been a good assignment maybe in some of the circumstances and some of the time frame, but it was bad at the time.
I'm not sure if you've heard of some of the more recent articles and literature being published by some of the former anti-war protesters that are alleging the statements from veterans, Vietnam veterans, the stories about veterans being spit upon and being poorly received when they came back to the United States, that all these are lies, that never happened. That the anti-war students on campuses and communities around the United States were peaceful protesters, didn't mistreat people as individuals.
Nobody ever mistreated me as an individual. They were pretty blatant at spray painting an Army sedan or breaking out a recruiting station window and calling you a pig or whatever walking down the street. But I mean, you know, what the hell are you going to do about it? You know, you can't do anything about it. So nobody come up and spit on me. I think if he had, I would have smashed his head in. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't know what I'd have done at the time, but nobody did that. They'd heckle you and you weren't well received.
How would they heckle you? How would they heckle you? What would they say?
Oh, they would, if you were walking through the campus, and after a while we quit walking through campuses. I mean, if we had to go somewhere to get something, we got the guy that would go in civilian clothes. I mean, that's what recruiters got to that. And like I said, they parked the car somewhere away from the recruiting station so nobody would know it was their car. Because almost all of them had a government sticker on her for whatever base they were going to get the commissary. And then they'd walk up to the recruiting station in civilian clothes, go inside and change clothes. And they wouldn't keep a sedan there.
How were you heckled, do you remember?
The baby killer? Oh, sometimes you did baby killer and warmonger, and you know, things, phrases like that. And,
okay. How long did you
puppets and you know, whatever? How long did I stay on recruiting duty? I volunteered to go back to Vietnam in July of the next year.
Okay. And why did you decide to volunteer to go back?
I didn't like recruiting duty that much. My boss on recruiting duty didn't like me that much. And it was just needed to be done. I needed to go someplace. And recruiting was a high priority. The only thing more of a high priority than recruiting duty was Vietnam. And so if I volunteered for any place else, it would have been a no-go. So that was the only logical thing to do. And infantry officers, it was probably only a period of 3 or 4 months, one way or another, anyway, as an infantry officer, before I'd been recycled anyway.
Now, since you volunteered to go back, could you choose your assignment?
Yeah. I chose I could choose to go to American Unit or or Vietnam, or MACV. Okay. And I chose an American unit. And then they chose 101st Airborne for me.
And that's when you arrived at 101st, they evaluated you based on your experiences and put you in service?
No. Or that was the end of my tour.
Oh, that was the end of your tour. What did you do for the first half of your tour?
First part of my tour, I was, first 2.5 months, I was the S1, or the personnel officer of the 1st Brigade. And then I was assigned as the S3, or the operations officer, of the 2nd Battalion of the 502nd Infantry.
Okay. And then?
And then I went to search.
Then you went to search?
Search at the end. I had to extend in that job.
In search?
No, in 101st. Because I wanted to go to bootstrap, finish up my college degree. Mm-hmm. And in order to get in line to go to the January semester, starting into January semester, my tour in Nam was going to, my 1 year tour would end in September, so I had to volunteer to stay in Nam until the end of December in order to fit time wise into going to bootstrap. Okay.
And this was September 69 to
September 69. I got there in September 69, came home in December of 70.
What were the biggest differences between doing your job as an S1, then an S3, and then with CERTS, compared to what you'd done previously in Vietnam?
Number one,
dealing with Americans.
And it wasn't trying to convince somebody to do something that you thought they ought to do. Mm-hmm. It's if you thought they ought to do it, you told them to do it, and it got done, hopefully. And that was the main thing. You were dealing with Americans that were going to follow out what you told them to do, hopefully, most of the time. We did work on joint operations with Vietnamese Army units while we were up there.
And where were you in country?
210 province, which is in up near Hue. We base camp of the 101st Division at that time was right outside of Hue.
And what had changed in terms of, I don't know, were there any changes as far as rules of engagement, any changes as far as your in-country briefings when you arrived for your second tour? What was the atmosphere different in terms of what we were trying to accomplish? Because, of course, Nixon's already announced the Vietnamization program. We're Vietnamizing this war, which means American withdrawal eventually.
Yeah. The rules of engagement, as an advisor, we always deferred to the Vietnamese. He had the choice. I mean, as I was telling you about the sandpans, Major Dong, there's some sandpans there. Do you want to shoot? And he said, yes. I tell Americans to shoot, and they shoot. And our rules of engagement in the 101st, because my brigade and the battalion I was in, we were in the canopy at all times. The rules of engagement out there was anybody that's out there was fair game. So we didn't.
It was a free fire zone.
It was a free fire zone, yeah. We didn't have any problem shooting anything we came across, because anything we came across wasn't supposed to be there. So that was the rules of engagement down lower land were different.
Yes.
The battalion that operated in the populated area, they were restricted from bringing artillery in until they cleared to make sure that it was defined as the Viet Cong or NVA. We didn't have Viet Cong. Maybe we had some, but 90% of the contacts we made in the 101st Battalion and I were all NVA.
Hmm. How frequent were those contacts?
Hopefully every 2 days. And I say hopefully because every time a unit went too long a period of time without some contact, when it had contact, it took casualties. as opposed to you got lax. Mm-hmm. The longer they went without contact, the more lax they got. Mm-hmm. And then when the contact occurred, a unit would get more casualties. Mm-hmm. So personally, I was hoping for contact more frequently than. But we had contact in every company. Somewhere in the battalion, we had contact every day. One of the companies. And what we operated on, we operated the battalion on a fire base with one company securing the fire base and the other companies in the canopy. And each company had an area of operation that it would work in. So they were all working independent of each other, ambushing trails and doing search and destroy or whatever, searching for caches and whatever and ambushing them. So each company was working its own individual area of operation.
Was there any overlap of those AOs?
No. So you don't have any friendly fire. Yeah. You got overlap, you got friendly fire.
Right.
And when I first joined the battalion, the fire base, they had been on this fire base for 2.5 months, I guess. And they had hardened the fire base and they built themselves nice hooches. And it was a nice thing. It was a showpiece. It was a wonderful thing. But we'd been there so long that Charlie had figured out every broken piece of wire we had or whatever. And I joined the battalion, and some 7 days later, Charlie visited us one night and with sappers, and he overran the fire base. And we lost 11, I guess we got 11 killed on the fire base, and he threw satchel charges everywhere. So we had sort of an unpleasant situation there.
What changed?
The problem we had at that time was we didn't have one of our companies on the fire base. The security, the perimeter of the fire base was with the Vietnamese company for the 54th Battalion of the 1st Armored Division. And I guess the major change after that occurred is that we never let an Arvin unit secure the perimeter of a fire base. I'm not saying that they were the fault, don't get me wrong. I say the fault was we stayed one place for 3 months and got fixed in what we were doing, and they had time to scope out and make a plan how to do it, and we were in the siege mentality, and they figured out how to break the siege and do it. And I don't blame it on the ARF, but hadn't. I think it was just our operational procedure. But after that, we did change operational procedures. We moved about every 7 to 10 days. After that, we just pop up and move to a new fire base. Of course, that takes a lot of work, but you're paying by the hour, so it doesn't matter. So after that little thing, we started moving.
Now, would just the headquarters fire base move, or would the companies also move in so the areas of operation?
Sometimes the companies would stay within there, out in the field in the same locations.
Okay.
And what we basically would do is on the fire base, we would pull one company in out of the field, let it take up the perimeter security of the fire base, and take the company that was securing the fire base and put it out in the field into an AO. About a month after that happened, our battalion was designated the swing battalion of the division. And what we did then is we replaced another battalion that pulled back into the base camp for stand down for a week. And we take over their fire base or another fire base in their area of operation and take over operating their area of operation for the week that they were back. And then they would come back out and we would go to another area of operation and take it over. Well, that battalion went back in for a week, stand down. And during the stand down, everybody got to see the dentist, the doctor, check your payroll, take a shower, whatever, you know, everything administratively and a little relief. And because of the number of battalions we had in the division, so you get back in about every 8 to 9 weeks, you were out 8 and back 1, and then back out for another 8. And so we, that my battalion did that hopscotch the rest of the time that I was in the battalion.
Mm-hmm. Now, so during that period, you were the S3.
Yes, I was the operations officer. Mm-hmm.
What was it like in terms of as you jumped around to these new bases? Was there ever any comparison to what the previous unit would engage and what they had encountered while they would patrol those AOs to what your unit would as a new unit, a fresh unit into this area, and maybe finding new contacts, more contacts, anything like that?
We almost always went to a different fire base than the previous battalion was on. So we went into a new, and set up a new fire base, and they just pulled off of there and went back to the rear.
Right.
And then we inserted our companies and aerosol into the areas. We usually come up with different things. I mean, because we were new, we didn't know the area as well as they did, perhaps, because they'd been there for a while. And we did our thing, and our thing was a little different than theirs as far as our patrolling tactics. Maybe we disrupted them a little bit, but we'd find different things that they hadn't found even though they'd been there for a while. We went into I guess it was Firebase Bagel. And when we got into Firebase Bagel, we put our recon platoon up on a hill, and they got into a little trouble, and we put B Company in behind them, and that didn't do any good. And so we put A Company in, and that didn't do any good. And we kept piling on this thing, and we didn't realize that we had, this was a more or less a new sector that nobody had been in before for a while. And we didn't realize that we selected the hill to go into that happened to be the 29th NVA Regiment's base camp. So we committed everything we had, and we borrowed 2 companies from another battalion to continue the thing until we finally cleared the area. Well, it took us a couple of weeks to get that little thing settled out. The battalion for that operation got the Valor's Unit Award for the action on the Hill 882 in contact with the 29th NVA Regiment. And that was the first, up until that time, it was an ambush here of a squad or a platoon or, you know, just little stuff. And that was the first time we got into a pitched battle against people that were dug in bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a significant, I don't remember the number now, but it's in the reports, a significant number of casualties, and so did they. Mm-hmm. And we got a whole parcel full of weapons and medical supplies and everything else out of the thing. So it was a good operation. But it was, you know, we just got there and we picked. I mean, no intelligence told mm-hmm. us to pick the hill, but we picked the hill, and we jumped fire bases right in the middle of this operation because the division said you're not going to stay on one any longer than a week because we don't want this kind of thing to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So we jumped in the middle of the week, and I think that when we jumped, I think we were the deciding factor. The NVA finally breaking and pulling out because we jumped our fire base closer into it, right into the almost into the middle of it, and it tended to settle off after that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then we during that period there was the next jump we made, we went to another fire base, and all this super secret stuff, we got this usually reliable source, whatever the hell that was, that they were going to make a human wave attack and try to run us out of the area. And as you know, you're talking about we're in the Vietnamization process, and the division was now at that status that we didn't want to take huge casualties, and we didn't want to lose anything bad. Mm-hmm. So we got mortared, and they didn't attack, but they mortared us, and we lost 4 or 5 killed or something. But they put up a flare ship, and they had a C-130, just flew a circle around us. So for 2 nights in a row, it just flew circles around us. All they did is drop flares all night long. It kept the place lit up all night long, you know. And they brought in some B-52 strikes, and they brought in air strikes. I don't know what they brought them in on. I mean, like, I wasn't directing any of that. That was somebody with intelligence in the rear was looking at maps, and we were just blowing the hell out of everything. But I don't know what we blew up, but we were. But anyway, the division was bound and determined they were not going to lose a battalion out there in the edge of the Ashaw Valley, mm-hmm. with a human wave attack. And that was what the, quote, usually reliable intelligence source said was going to happen. So we bombed and shelled, and the 8-inch artillery from the next fire base back that supported us fired all night long, and we fired all night long, and it was, but nobody came. We gave a party and nobody come to it. But it was one of those odd things that they never told me. Right? Well, I was not cleared for that super secret stuff. What all this was about, other than it was supposed to be a, you know, human wave attack that's supposed to take us out. Some North Korean and North Vietnamese regiment were going to take us. So anyway, we got that experience.
Well, as the S3, were you tasked with sending out patrols to do battle damage assessments to see what was hit, if anything? And
well, we sent people out, you know, and worked the area afterwards and didn't find essentially anything other than the site where we got mortared from. We found the results of that, and we got that. Got one of their tubes, and you know, but most of the stuff, you know, B-52 strike is, you know, it doesn't leave a lot of evidence around. I mean, it leaves some, but it doesn't leave a lot. But we went back out and tried to find out if there was anything, if we succeeded in anything. We never really found anything. So whether there was or not, or whether their intelligence was spooky, I don't know. But maybe because of the flare ship and all the bombing, they decided to go someplace else. I don't know. It was supposed to be in the same unit that took Ripcord. 3 months later, they took Ripcord, or they caused the Ripcord incident, I believe. Where that one or not.
Just a little bit familiar, what did you hear about it while you were in country?
Well, I watched it while I was in country. Ripcord was another fire base that got essentially surrounded by NVA, and they kept shelling it, and finally we had to abandon it and evacuate it. The battalion commander was killed during the evacuation. Lieutenant Colonel Lucas, he got the Medal of Honor for that action on the fire base. Andre Lucas is his name. But anyway, that was the same unit that was supposed to be doing this human wave on us was the unit that was involved in his activity.
Mm-hmm. And while you were S3, how good did you estimate the intelligence you received in making your plans for your battalion?
As S3, I didn't make any plans based on intelligence.
Okay.
That, other than geographical intelligence.
Why not?
It, in essence, didn't exist.
Okay, why not?
No.
We didn't have any military intelligence.
Well, you see, you got an S2, which is your intelligence officer, and he's supposed to know, but he can tell you, he can tell you that so certain enemy units were operating in this area, but where they are, he doesn't know. And what we did is we had an area of operation, and we divided that up by in terrain features, and some were smaller than bigger, and we determined how we were going to go into that area and search the area to try to find him. And if he was there, we would find him, or he would slip away, or whatever happened. And, but we, the entire time that I was the S3, my S2 never got intelligence that the enemy's located at that location. Other than this time when we were on a fire base and we were supposed to be getting overrun, is the only piece of hard intelligence that I ever got what the enemy was going to do. Mm-hmm. Once we found the enemy, we knew where he was. But otherwise, we had an AO, and we operated in that AO against what, by terrain analysis, where he would most probably be. Mm-hmm. And that was what the S2 would come up. This is the most probable location based upon terrain, availability of water, trail network, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the best chance we got. It's probably this area, so that we target that area. But as far as having hard intelligence, if there was any enemy anywhere, we never had it.
How did that strike you? Were you surprised, or?
No, I don't guess I was. I just, because I, he was, he moved around, he was elusive, and we weren't that good at intelligence. I mean, the usual reliable source was normally ASA or one of these people getting a radio message, and radio, you know, intercept type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But as far as us knowing or having anybody behind the lines or anything like that, now some of the special forces people, they had data on units that were moving somewhere, and they may bring an airstrike in on it. Mm-hmm. So forth. But as far as knowing where the local NVA was, we didn't know.
What about the use of scouts, recon, snipers?
Well, that's what we were doing all the time.
But they weren't bringing, they weren't smaller units going out, bringing back intelligence on larger unit movements so that American
forces... We didn't operate any... Now, the Ranger Company went out and did some of that. Trail watching and so forth. Mm-hmm. But as far as our battalion went, we didn't go out and try to find anything out. We gave a area of operation to a company, and with a map reconnaissance, the highest probability was that this would be a trail network they would use. Mm-hmm. And we would set a company out there, and they ambushed this trail for, and then it, with a platoon, and the other two platoons would work a sweep over this way, and maybe it would force some people down this trail past the ambush and whatever. But we stumbled on it. When we found Charlie, we stumbled on him. Or he found us. And that was just about the way we operated most of the time. Now, this firebase ripcord, was that the Viet Cong, I mean, the VC were in the area, or not the VC, but NVA were in the area, and they put this firebase out there, and it was the wrong place, and Charlie didn't want it there, and he made a concentrated effort to get rid of it, and he got rid of it. But that was towards the end, that was in, I guess, July of 70, somewhere along there, August of 70, something, and that was towards the end when we weren't willing to step up and, you know, take tremendous casualties. But it wasn't like 2 years prior when we had Hamburger Hill. Mm-hmm. It was almost a run-written rule we weren't going to have any more Hamburger Hills. Just, you know, just for a piece of terrain.
Speaking of Hamburger Hill, were there any friendly fire incidents while you were at the 101st?
Any what?
Friendly fire incidents.
Oh, yes, there were. In the battalion when I was the S3, didn't have any, but there were, in my battalion, there were friendly fire incidents. In fact, I think we were extremely lucky that we didn't have one on Hill 882 because we had a lot of air strikes coming in, but we didn't. I was an investigating officer on several of them.
Really?
For somebody else, some of the battalion. Or,
mm-hmm.
And most of the friendly fire incidents were a short round or, mm-hmm. you know, they were just, there were very seldom there were negligence, you know. In mm-hmm. fact, the ones I investigated, there were none negligence. They were just one of those.
It's a freak accident.
Freak accidents. Or you tell an air jet to drop a 500-pound bomb, well, it strayed 10 feet to the right and shrapnel went as far as it did, you know. And it's just one of those unfortunate things, I think, sometimes. But every now and then there were some things that people screwed up. I got wounded in one when I was in service. We were having an artillery adjustment demonstration for the new troops.
Mm-hmm.
And the battery that was firing our fire force fired short round. And I happened to be the stupid fool who was down there and took the shrapnel. I was the only one that got hit. But it was no big thing. But I mean, it was, and then, because we went back and found out that the executive officer was supposed to be the firing officer, was in the mess hall having coffee and hadn't gone out and checked the lay of the guns. And his problem occurred at that time was because the reason that I was out watching the demonstration that morning is because we had the Diverti commander with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went back with me to find out what happened, and when he found out his company exec was, or battery exec was in the mess hall, mm-hmm. having coffee instead of on the battery, he had the problem, and he solved the problem, I guess, because he relieved the company commander and the battery commander and the battery exec both at the time, and did their career, and I'm assuming it, but anyway. But I was just, you know, those are the kind of things that happen. Somebody not checking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but we never had a case of an infantry platoon jumping another infantry platoon and shooting it out with each other. And those things did happen over there. Mm-hmm. We never had that because we had an area of operation that was separated enough that nobody was going to jump in each other. And if we had a platoon in one company get over close to their sector line, we made sure the other company on the next
mm-hmm.
area operation over here knew that they were over near theirs and to watch out and,
mm-hmm.
and not get involved and shoot out with each other.
Okay.
So we never had, in the battalion I was in, we never had trouble with a friendly fire incident.
Now, one of my interests or one of my concerns was, did you as S3 and did your commander ever concern, were you ever concerned about the fact that by having those area of operations that you maintained that distance to make sure there were no friendly fire incidents, but that of course eventually could be figured out by the enemy that this is an area that's kind of safe, you know, because we know they're not going to get them too close together because they don't want incidents. So if there's any place that might be a soft spot, that might be it.
That didn't bother me because I only stayed there a week. I worked this area a week, and then our battalion moved to another fire base.
Right.
And then we set up, the other battalion moved out, and we set up
yeah.
our areas of operation different from what they had.
Yeah.
And so we were a new kid on the block every week.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not saying that couldn't have happened if you stayed in the same
mm-hmm.
thing for a period of time, and that may have been the problem that we had on the fire base rifle when we got overrun.
Mm-hmm.
We were there too long and got too complacent and too set in our procedures and whatever. That's what happened to us on that.
Okay.
But
how about fragging incidents? Were there any fragging incidents in the 101st while you were there?
Yeah, there were a couple. The sergeant major in my battalion didn't get fragged. He got burnt. Well, I don't know how he started the thing. He threw an incendiary grenade in his hooch.
Oh, God.
Caught it on fire. But the only thing we lost was the hooch. He was Sergeant Major Sabalowski. Was an old soldier. I mean, old. Mm-hmm. Second World War. You know, I almost think he came from the First World War. But he was a dedicated soldier. I mean, he was a strict disciplinarian. You had to, and the troops in the rear area hated his guts, and the troops in the field loved him when he was out there with them, because he was with them. They felt 100% safer, because he knew what was going on, and he made them do what was right. And he took care of them. But in the rear area, he was kicking their butt to get the boots shined and clean up and get a new uniform on. And the troops in the rear area didn't appreciate it near as much as they should have. But, and he did get an incendiary grenade or something thrown in his hooch and caught it on fire. He wasn't even in it when it happened. So
I was lucky.
Yeah. Well, he'd have got out, I'm sure.
Yeah. Maybe done on purpose as a warning.
Yeah. But it didn't slow him down. I mean, he was not the hate.
Mm-hmm.
He kept on going the way. He never changed a bit.
Okay. Let me go ahead and pause for a moment and change out the CDs. This will end CD number 2. This is CD number 3 of the interview with Mr. Thomas Spencer on the 8th of October, 2001. You mentioned that there were several fragging incidents. What were the others?
Somebody, you know, tossed a grenade that gets... Usually at the some headquarters hooch or officer's hooch or whatever. And I don't, you know, I heard about them, and I didn't go look at them, or they were all camp people concerned. There was some dissension among the troops. The longer it got into 70, I guess, because we were the down run.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 101st, or at least ways my battalion, I was in the brigade that I was in, the 1st Brigade. We had reasonably decent discipline and morale and whatever you want to call it. I hear stories of the rampant drug use and whatever, but I never saw it, and it didn't exist in the units where people were taking care of things.
Okay.
In the 1st Brigade, we had a portion of the bunker line at Camp Eagle, and the battalion, each battalion had a portion of the bunker line around the whole camp. But in the 1st Brigade, the brigade staff, in addition to the battalion staff that went out and checking their battalion, the brigade staff was also going out checking the bunker line and making sure the troops were awake and alert in the bunkers and weren't sitting there smoking marijuana and so forth. And so we were checking, and I'm not saying there wasn't any drugs. I'm just saying that it was not rampant and out of hand like it's depicted in some mm-hmm. some circles.
Mm-hmm.
Troops that came back to the rear came back for a purpose, their medical purpose, or had personal problems, had to get their finances straightened out, or their teeth and need to have a tooth taken out or off, whatever it was. But We had NCOs and officers in the rear that were checking the barracks, and people weren't sitting around the hooch with nothing to do with and smoking pot. We didn't put up with that trash. I mean, we were doing what we were supposed to be doing, at least wasn't the 1st Brigade. Now, I wasn't ever down in the 2nd Brigade or the 3rd Brigade, so I don't know what they were doing. So, but in the brigade that I was in, we were the brigade staff officers and the battalion staff officers that were in the rear were pretty much hounding the troops to the point that they were alert on the bunker lines and they had something to do in the rear area all the time, so they weren't just nothing to do and sitting around trying to smoke pot. While I was in search, of course they were new in country, we'd get them for a week, maybe a week and a day, and they would be gone. We did get some other troops in, and I ran a sniper school, and the kids would come in to go to sniper school, and they were long in country, but they were always good soldiers, so they weren't a problem. We ran a recondo school type thing where we taught rappelling and stuff like that. And so those troops that were come from in country and come in, and they were always selected because they were some of the better troops. And the new troops in country hadn't been there long enough to figure out where to find their dope or anything yet, so they didn't have any. So all in all, I think the rear area, I had a little bit of a problem at search. Guy stuck a note on my door, something, watch your step or we're going to get you or something like that. I don't remember the word. I kept it, still got it in my scrapbook. But it was one of those things that, give me a break. I mean, I had taken over and I was making some changes, and I realized that. I mean, I changed the fact that some of these things that they've been doing were not going to be done anymore, and they were going to do some other things. And, you know, a new broom sweeps clean, you know, and does its changes. And so I got a note like that. But nothing ever happened of it, and I don't think he'd gone through a newspaper and cut out words out of a newspaper and pasted them on this sheet of stationery and thumbtacked it on the door of my office.
What do you think it came from? One of your permanent staff?
Yeah, that's where it came from. I mean, I wasn't hassling the new troops that were coming in. I was hassling the old staff because some of the things they were not up to snuff. And I was making some changes to things that were going to happen. It had to come from one end. It was probably one of the lower enlisted. I don't know. But I ignored it, and he didn't frag me. So I guess I was all right.
Was that the only threat you ever received?
Yeah. One guy said he wasn't going to go to the field for me in the battalion, and I told him he was. He said he wasn't, and I gave him his weapon, loaded it for him, and said he had two choices, either shoot me or go to the field, and he decided he'd go to the field rather than shoot me. So, I mean, we get people, he'd refused to go to the field for his lieutenant. So, then didn't know what to do with him. He came and got me, and I said, give me his equipment, give me his gun, put a magazine in the chamber, and handed it to him and said, you get two choices. You're going to shoot me or you're going to go on the field, because the four of us are going to pick you up and carry you up and put you in the helicopter. You can go kicking and screaming, or you can start shooting, and you got a loaded weapon. You take your choice. Or you can walk up there like a man to get on the helicopter. Got his rucksack and walked up there and got on his helicopter and flew away. I mean, they'll try to run. I mean, they're just like a little kid in your house, you know. You know, a little kid will tell you no until you whack him alongside the head, and then you do what you tell him to. But, you know. Mm-hmm. And I understood it. He just didn't want to go back out there.
Yeah. Did you encounter that much? Did you encounter that much?
No, only a couple of cases. People got wheezy. I remember some replacements we got one time. We were taking them out to the field, and we were unloading body bags off the helicopter they were going to go out in, and that was not a good scene. But sometimes that happens, you know. So they had to unload the body bags of the guys they were replacing when they got on the helicopter to go out. course, I know that made their stomach feel real good on the flight out. Mm-hmm. But I've only had a couple of times, I don't know, where somebody wanted to refuse. Both times they went, ultimately they went on and did what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that type of activity was demoralizing? The new recruit going up to the chopper, taking off the bus.
It's not a good feeling. I can see that. You know, if it was any other way to prevent it, I wouldn't do it. But it just happened to be the log bird to come back in to pick him up, having to bring back body bags. Mm-hmm. You know, we avoided that if all possible. I mean, that wasn't the kind of a scene you want a new recruit going out to the field to see. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it had to be. You know. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's not good. It's not good morale builder up to start with. But then again, maybe it got his adrenaline up and got him alert and more so than ever. I don't know. That's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. Certainly brings the reality of war very quickly to the new recruit. Is the S3, did you ever arrange for training? I mean, obviously you're in charge of operations, trying to get these guys into the areas where they'll make contact and do some good for the war. How about?
The only chance you had for training was during the 1 week stand down you got every ninth week when you came back. And we usually did some remedial training in that period of time. Occasionally I would schedule people to go search for rappel training, because we rappel out of helicopters with but most of those were recon individuals being assigned to the reconnaissance platoon. But we would do some specialized training during that stand down period back in the rear. And we had about 2.5 days of the week that we did some training. And the first day back was sobering up from the first night back, usually. I mean, that was just one of those things that happened. Yeah. And then during that stand down, they all got to go see the dentist, and they got to see the doctor, and they got their payroll checked, and their personnel record checked, and got new boots or equipment or, you know, completely did all that kind of jazz with administrative. And we tried to give them a couple of days that were just theirs, you know, just to lay around and do nothing, to relax. But about 2.5 days of training we scheduled, specialized training in whatever aspect we thought we were efficient in, talking to the company commanders and everything. And then scheduling the people from special schools, and that's about all the training that we had time for. So the training we didn't do too much of, as far as the job of S3.
Was there anything else, any other operations or anything that stand out in your memory as being interesting, significant?
We did several instances. We rappelled out, you know, rappelled a platoon into to an area, and then usually rappelled an infantry platoon in, and a squad of engineers in, and then squatted. Infantry would sort of secure the area, and then a squad of engineers would blow an area big enough to get a Huey in, and then we just bring in the rest of the company in. And we did that quite a few times. One time we did it and got away with it until the last man was going down the rope, and some crazy NBA stuck his head out and went with an AK-47 and got the pilot. Scared to flip dip out of the co-pilot, he pulled the collective, I guess, out of the floor, so the bird went like this. And here's old Blow still on the rope, you know. That was, looking back at it now, it was a funny sight to behold. But I know at the time, the poor kid, this bird's going off like this. This kid's scared, flipless. He's on the rope, and the people are shooting, and and the bird taking off with him, hanging out there on him. And the bird getting higher and higher away from the ground, and all he's doing, he's holding on that propeller rope, and saying, what the hell do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
But the bird would take off, and then the crew chief and the door gunner were doing the best they could. They finally got him up into the bird, just as the bird, the co-pilot had to set it into to an LZ because he hit hydraulic line or something, whatever else. And they had another bird come immediately in, picked up the pilot, and took him to the hospital, and he took it in the head, and the bullet had gone through his helmet, went around on him between his head and his helmet, and come out the front, and all it did is leave him with a crease around his head.
Huh.
Weird. But he lived.
Yeah.
Took it in the head and lived. But I talked to the Spec 4 later, and he said he'd never been so scared in his life. He didn't know whether the bird was going to crash or what was going to happen. But it was. But we did quite a bit of that kind of activity to get into areas we would have had to take 3 days or 4 days to walk into to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you walk in a direction 3 or 4 days, if anything is there, it's gone. It's packed up, and carried all it wanted to carry off, and it's gone the other way.
Did you ever use daisy cutters to clear those types of areas? For helicopters to come in for, you know, basically create landing zones using daisy cutters?
They did sometimes, yeah. And but most of the time we tended to cut our own. A platoon to reach an area that was good, and they cut an LZ for resupply.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we cut an LZ, we were expanding our ability to reinforce and get into areas and out of areas and everything. Mm-hmm. So we tended to want to cut as many LZs as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were only one ship LZs, but that was enough, you know, unless it could. Became too hot or something, but usually we could get them as many as we could get cut. We did. So we had these little LZs cut all over the. Every ridgeline had one on, practically.
And how available was close air support? You were too far inland for naval gunfire.
Right? No,
could get naval gunfire?
We got some, not all the time, but we got some from a destroyer off the coast.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we had with that is that we didn't always have naval gunfire with us.
Mm-hmm.
And they like to have their own man on the ground to control stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And but they did, they were out there and they could support us.
How about close air support?
It was, never had any problem getting any.
Okay.
Of course, we were an air mobile division and we had our own aerial rocket artillery, so it was almost always available, depending on, you know, who else might have higher priority in the division than you did. It was almost always available.
Was there any ADA in the area where you were, air defense artillery?
I don't remember ever seeing any. I don't think there was. There may have been, but I don't remember seeing any. I don't think there was.
Did you ever receive briefings that there might be an air threat from the enemy side?
We did have quad 50s, which are basically an air defense, but they were all utilized for ground.
They were anti-personnel.
Anti-personnel.
Yeah.
And they were pretty good at eating up a piece of terrain as far as you know, when they got through chewing up a piece of ground, you were fairly sure that there wasn't something there.
Mm-hmm.
But
You could use it for bunkers and trenches and trench lines, things like that.
Yeah, they were setting on the bunker line, you know, like to control the fire support for the bunker line, and they were truck mounted, or they were taken off the truck, slung underneath the helicopter, and they were flown out. A couple of them were on fire bases. And on fire bases that were sitting in the valley with hills around them like that, so that the Quad 50 could fire at the hillside across the little valley from them, mm-hmm. things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But we had the Quad 50s. And that's the only air defense, pure air defense thing that, that I ever saw in country.
Mm-hmm. I thought that the Quad 50, was it not against the Geneva Conventions to use that against personnel?
Not that I know of.
Oh, okay.
If it is, I didn't read it close enough.
I didn't know. But
we used it against personnel. That was its sole purpose.
For your unit, yeah. That's all you could use it against. I mean, that you're going up against. So. And was there anything else that you wanted to discuss with regard to your time with the service? We've talked about that some and spots here and there.
I don't know. There's a the 101st was a good unit. We had we seem to have operated in a pretty good state of affairs. As far as the people in the unit, at this stage in the war, we were down to NCOs being a lot of shake and bakes.
Mm-hmm.
Senior NCOs were getting scarcer and scarcer, and I don't know whether that was a failure in the turnover system or the fact that by this time more people were getting out of the service. They're 20 years from the Second World War being up,
mm-hmm.
and or this 20 years from the Korean War was coming up and they were getting out, but we didn't seem to get as many of the old hardline NCOs that we used to get. The Sergeant Major Savolovsky that I mentioned, he was one of the few that seemed to be around in the old days. The lieutenants, and I don't know why, maybe it was society, but the lieutenants in the 70s tended to be of a mindset that they wanted to be friends. They wanted everybody in the platoon to be their friend. And that was bad because they, these 32 kids, they didn't need another friend, they needed a daddy to keep them alive. And that was a hard thing. I used to almost beat that into some of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, don't get to be friends with these kids because you're deciding between him and him who's going on point to die. And you, if they're your buddies, and you can't be making those clear, distinct decisions, and you're not making the hard, you know, you got to clean your weapon before you go to bed. You know, as soon as you stop, clean your weapon, get it ready for the next go around. I mean, you got to be kicking people in the butt because the private only does what you make him do. If you don't make him do anything, he's tired. He's humped a ruck 9 hours that day, and he's dead tired, and he wants to get some sleep. But if you don't make him clean that weapon before he goes to sleep, he ain't going to clean it before he goes to sleep. And they had a lot of trouble with the young lieutenant wanting to distance themselves from the men and be the strong leader for them, as opposed to 4 or 5 years earlier than that. the lieutenants we were getting. And I don't know why, whether it was part of society or what, because we were getting kids out of college. I mean, that's where they were coming from, the ROTC, most of them were ROTC, OCS, or whatever. But they tended to want to be more buddy-buddy than the daddy figure.
Mm-hmm. And did that cause specific problems that you identified in addition, like cleaning weapons?
The problem it caused, I think, is they weren't as, the platoon might not have been as ready as it should have been. Do you dig in tonight or do you just sort of slough it off? And you read in books someplace where they only dug a half a foxhole or they only scooped a little dirt out. But if they dug in like they should have, maybe more of them would have survived, even if it was enforcing the discipline that they should have enforced. And they didn't do that because they were friends, and that was an aspect that came in. And part of the cause of that was a captain was only 2 years in the service. You know, he's the second lieutenant for a year, the first lieutenant for a year. Now he's the captain, and he's supposed to be teaching the second lieutenant what to do, and he hadn't figured out what to do yet. Mm-hmm. And he's already a company commander. So, whereas before, you were second lieutenant for 18 months, and you were first lieutenant for 4.5 years, and then you were a captain for another 4, 5, 6 years, 7 years, or something before you became a major. And we condensed that whole span down. And therefore, the leadership at the lower ranks towards the end was strained, I think, mm-hmm. because of the speed up in promotions and the lack of experience that the people had. Now, they may have had experience in country for a year, but they still lack some of that background experience that they had, should have had. Whereas in 65, 66, probably every captain we sent to Vietnam had been in the Army 7, 8 years or more, probably. But in 1970, they were only been in the Army for a couple of years when they were becoming company. And I think that had an effect upon the quality of leadership. I'm not saying they were bad leaders or anything. I'm just saying, the experience that they had and the decisions they might have made might have been different or better had they had more experience in the background.
What did you think about the 365-day rotation system?
It was not good. You really learned a job and then you moved on. Like I had 3 jobs in that year and 3 months that I was there in the 101st. You were rotating. By the time they got really good in their job, you were rotating it out so somebody else could get in and get their ticket punched or whatever you want to call it, phrase, and get out. Converse to that, we had generals that stayed in Saigon forever, and I don't think that was good. I chatted with some guys, and we said, if we would have not let an air conditioner get in Vietnam, we kept the PX out of Vietnam, and we made the general officer sleep in tents, we would have probably been home in 2 years. Because there was a whole different world. The general in the 101st Airborne Division had a mobile home. All the generals had a mobile home in the field. I mean, I'm talking about 10 foot wide, 50 foot long, mobile home. The troops are sleeping in little sea huts or tents or whatever, and the general officers that are prosecuting this war are living in a completely different style or society. And the people, generals in Saigon, are living in villas, French villas, and PX facilities and officers' clubs and the whole nine yards. And they're the ones that are prosecuting this thing. I think there was just too much of a difference there, and they lost some kind of concept of what the war was about, where the troops were and where the advisors were and what was going on. I think there was too much of a spread there. And of course, the general officers that stayed there for a while had their wives living in the Philippines, and they were flying over on once a month to have a concubinal visit with their wives and things like that. And the troops that were there were not getting this. So they got R&R twice, or R&R once in the league once. But still, there was a total difference of breaking down the from the highest grade to the lowest grade was a problem, I thought. I just didn't think that all the decisions might have been made differently if they'd had, you know, different living style. And I could be wrong, I don't know. That's just a personal perspective of mine.
Well, what did you think about the attrition strategy developed by Westmoreland, General Westmoreland?
I think MacArthur said that you can't fight attrition with an Oriental. You can't kill enough of them, especially when you're counting bodies that aren't there. If you go out and have a firefight and you lose four American soldiers, you've got to count at least 40 enemy bodies, or somebody thinks you did something wrong.
Did that happen in the 101st?
It didn't happen in my unit, but I don't doubt that it didn't happen. And a lot of it is you start estimating, you know. You had a fight, and then you brought an airstrike in and you blew this place all to Hades, and there's nothing left but pieces and well, a platoon was held down by four machine guns and a bunch of other people, and you blew it away. How many was there? Well, it was, I don't know how many was there. Four machine guns, that's two apiece, or that one man or two, that's eight, that's 22 people. I don't know. People came up with numbers like that. And they made their best estimate, I'm sure. But I'm also sure that when bad things went bad, and you went out and you found blood trails, and you estimated that you killed so many and they carried off their dead, I don't know that they always carried off the dead. Sometimes I think the dead weren't there, because if we were killing as many as we killed, we should have hurt them more than we did. So I'm thinking maybe we inflated our body counts. That's an honest opinion. Yeah. I never inflated one that crossed my desk. If the platoon leader told me he killed 10, that's what went in my report to higher headquarters. And I know for a fact sometimes things didn't leave higher headquarters with the same numbers.
So the inflation, from your perspective, occurred at multiple levels.
Yeah.
Or could have occurred at multiple
could
levels.
Could have occurred at multiple levels, yes.
Certainly if the S3 were a different person and had inflated them, then they got inflated again at higher headquarters, and I'm not the chain.
Yeah. I'm saying it happened. Yeah. I don't know how bad it happened, but I know it happened on occasions. And in the first place is the first man that makes the estimate.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you blew the whole thing away, and that somebody was there before the airstrike hit, and there was nobody there when the airstrike finished. How many was there when the airstrike went in? And you pull a number out of the air, or you make your best guess, mm-hmm. and that's when it went down. That best guess may have been inflated by 50% or 100%, I don't know. And it's a hard call, mm-hmm. but I think we probably tended to inflate the thing by human nature.
Yeah.
If I blew the enemy away and it was only four enemy and he held up my whole company, am I going to say it's only four enemy that held up my whole company? But it might have been only four enemy, and four enemy could have possibly done it.
Yeah.
But the tendency, I think, may be that we inflated our kill factors to compensate, you know, for what our own egos or whatever. Because we didn't have all those bodies. And I do know that. But when we did get bodies, we counted bodies and made reports. And I know that Arvin units counted civilians as DC. Because surely an Arvin unit would blow away his own people. So I know some of their units counted civilians that got killed in shelling this village as the VC, because the VC were there and the civilians were there, and when it's all over, they're all VC. It's just, and I don't think an attrition is a good way to win a war, or a good policy worth going on.
Did you notice any difference in the first tour you served under General Westmoreland and your second tour under General Abrams? Did you notice any difference from higher, from on high, in terms of the leadership style, what was happening in the country? I know it was two completely different types of assignment, but
the biggest difference, I think, is we turned the corner and we were in the Vietnamization, and that tended to be a deciding factor. In what we did.
And therefore influenced how much units were willing to sacrifice.
Yeah.
Which
we still went out and aggressively pursued the thing, but there was a line someplace that you weren't going to cross over just to take a piece of hilltop. And I think we got to that at Ripcord, you know, really, that really was a crowning blow or whatever. Because we reached the point that we were not willing to commit enough soldiers to keep this fire base. Mm-hmm. It's better to give it up and evacuate it than try to keep it, because we don't want to risk that many lives to do it.
Was there anything else that you wanted to discuss about your time with the 101st?
No, I think that's what comes to my mind so far. Mm-hmm.
John, did you have any questions?
No.
Yeah.
Well, when you left after your second tour, what did you think about the course of the war? How much confidence did you have in the South Vietnamese military?
We were, whatever you want to call it, Vietnamizing, and the South Vietnamese military, in the 101st Airborne Division area, was one of the first Army division, was one of the best divisions they had, and it was well led. And it was a good division, but my doubts, I don't think, were against the Arvin military per se, as much as it was my doubts that we had established in the country they had established in their southern country a political leadership system that was going to hold up, because by this time they'd gone through a couple more changes in Saigon, and their district chiefs, or whatever you want to call it, the province chiefs, were predominantly military officers, and that didn't, you know, bode well. That you're talking about free, democratic government, and yet the district chief, he's a military officer, and the province chief is a military officer. So we're not talking about a democratic government that the local people elected and were going to support. Mm-hmm. We're talking about officers that have been assigned down there by Saigon, they were not liked locally. They were corrupt or not corrupt, depending on the situation. Some were, Many weren't, but there were some corrupt ones, and they had a problem in that aspect, I thought, that the system just wasn't going to shake down, I didn't think.
But in, with regard to political issues, of course, we, the United States, had some problems too. And how important do you think Johnson's decision not to run for re-election in 68 was, especially on the mindset of the American people and the American soldiers over there fighting? Here's the commander-in-chief. He's kind of giving up. Was that how it was interpreted by people like yourself, or how did you view it?
I view Johnson not running again and getting somebody else because it is a good move, personally. Because my personal feeling is that the way we have been prosecuting the war wasn't too swift. This on and off again bombing, and I just wasn't happy, I guess, with what we had been doing. I didn't think we were fighting the war that we were supposed to be fighting. A conventional army is supposed to be in fighting for terrain and not fighting and winning the hearts and minds of the people. That should be advisors working with the locals and trying to upgrade their civilian leadership in their villages and rooting out the cells of the Viet Cong. But we hadn't been doing it. We'd quit doing, in essence, quit doing that, and we'd gone into a conventional or quasi-conventional war and attrition, and you know, we were fighting for a piece of terrain and turn around and leave it, and that didn't make a lot of sense from an army standpoint, or from my standpoint as a military person.
But how much did that change with Abrams and with President Nixon?
I don't think it changed that much. Abrams and Nixon were in the mode of getting us out, but as far as I can see, saw that Nixon drug his feet in doing it. Whether we promised to give them support forever and come back and bail them out if the North came south, we backed out on that. Maybe that was bad for us, but from an Army standpoint, when we started getting out, I was glad we were getting out, because I couldn't see us, personally, I couldn't see us winning the thing unless we were willing to go beyond where we were. And I don't think anybody in the world was willing to go beyond where we were. I think we were just dragging out an ultimate that was going to happen. And that was my personal feeling.
Well, what was it like when you came back from your second tour? When you came into the United States, was the atmosphere at all different from when you came back the first time?
When I came back, I went directly to the University of Nebraska at Omaha in the Bootstrap program. And at that time, that university was just clogged full of people like me. So half the students there were bootstrappers. So I was not all Army, but a bunch of Air Force and so on. And because often Air Force Base was right out there, there was a whole bunch of Air Force guys in there. And it was a pretty conservative, the war was not an unpopular thing on campus. They had an ROTC unit and the whole nine yards. So it was a pretty good feeling, I thought, in Omaha. I didn't have a problem with that. Went there 9 months, then went to Germany, and in Germany there was a lot of anti-war sentiment, you know, with splinter groups in Germany that wanted us to get out of Vietnam, whether they be communists or just radicals or what they were, but there was a lot of German individuals that wanted us out of Vietnam. And of course, we got out, you know, about 73.
Now, when you got it, when you came back from your second tour, and in subsequent years, especially say after January of 73, when we signed the Paris Peace Accords and kind of officially pulled out, did you feel comfortable talking about your experiences with other people? Your experiences in Southeast Asia?
I didn't talk to very many people other than other military about it. I was in Germany, and I didn't discuss it with the German people, and German civilians that I knew. I didn't discuss it with them. But I didn't have any, you know, we used to talk about it among ourselves, other guys that were stationed there.
Other veterans that were over there, too.
Military. But I didn't talk to the German civilians about it.
And how long did you stay in the military?
I stayed until 76, retired in 76.
What did you think about the Paris Peace Accords, and then what did you think when Saigon fell in April 75?
The Paris Peace Accords, I'm happy for them because, as I said, I had two classmates that were POWs, you know, getting the POWs back, and they both came back alive. That was good, and I thought, you know, it was good that had got this thing behind us, whatever you want to call it. I guess subconsciously I didn't expect anybody to adhere to it. I expected Ho Chi Minh to be the president of the whatever he was of all of Vietnam ultimately. Because I didn't think that the South was going to prevail against the North as far as the insurgency was going to go on. I did not expect an open assault quite as quickly as it happened. I figured it would probably be 10 years down the road coming that he just, you know, manipulate his way in and with guerrillas and whatever, and finally take over. But I didn't expect it to come as fast as it did.
Were you surprised when Congress decided not to continue supporting the South Vietnamese military with weapons and ammunition monetarily?
That was a I kind of thought we sort of pulled the rug from them on that one. I wasn't in favor of sending more people back there. But, you know, we led them to this point, and I kind of thought they deserved to have a little financial backing anyway, more so than we gave them. By that point in time, I was dead set against going back, because I continued to read, and the more I read, the more I got disturbed at what we'd done up to that point.
Mm-hmm. What disturbed you the most?
I guess in the ultimate is that we the government was not honest with the public. Mm-hmm. I don't think we were ever honest with the population as to what the hell we were doing, what it was costing, what we intended to achieve, and Nixon and Kissinger could have ended it a couple of years earlier than they did, on almost the same grounds that they ended it when they ended it, and those kind of things kind of bugged me. I mean, it was like, this is politics, and you know, 10,000 more dead soldiers for a little political whim or something, and we weren't up front with the people and telling them what was going on, and then years later we come out and the Gulf of Tonkin incident is not what it appeared to be the start with, that we went to Congress to convince them to give the War Powers Act, and you know, all those things were just, you know, this is not the greatest period in our governmental life, I don't think. And I think there was some serious things happened here that were wrong. And as I mentioned to your friend there, that I hope that, you know, the things that you're doing, trying to keep the history of this period, because somewhere down the line people are going to need to look at it. And if we don't study it, we're doomed to, and understand it, we're doomed to repeat it again sometime. And I hope we don't repeat something like this again sometime.
What do you think are the most important lessons we should take away from that experience?
Well, from a military standpoint, the most important lesson we should have taken away from this, whether we did or not, is that general officers have to stand up and tell the truth and be counted, even if it costs them their career. And I don't know whether we learned it or not. If this is not a good move, Mr. President, we shouldn't do this. And if he tells them to do it, then they're duty bound to go ahead and say, yes, sir, we're going to do it. But they've also got the option to put the papers on the desk and says, I retire, and go out on the civilian side and say, hey, I raised my hand, this is not right. And if we remember, we had a general that came out of Korea that said, hey, what we're doing is not right, we got to do something different over there. And we shouldn't be punishing generals who stand up and be counted and say something that's against the policy. Truman did MacArthur, and I don't fault that, because MacArthur was a little out of hand. But General Singlob spoke out in Korea, and he got punished because he spoke out in Korea against some policies. I think when you start punishing people that are speaking out on those military issues, you start closing their mouths, and then we're not getting a true picture. And if we're not getting a true picture, then we're sacrificing the youth of the nation for causes that are not winnable or not proper or false or whatever. And I don't think we should be doing that. And that's the biggest lesson that we should have learned from that, is to me, that the general officers should have stood up and said, hey, this ain't working. Now we can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. There ain't no light at the end of the tunnel. This is a 15-year, 20-year project we're involved in. We got to take this one hamlet at a time, one sector at a time, one province at a time, and gradually build this nation back up and get rid of the thing. This is going to be a 20-year job. And if they'd said that and all stood up, I don't think we'd have got near as deep as we did in that, as quick as we did. You know, we're going to send a division over there, and that was going to fix it. I mean, put another division in, that fix it. Those weren't fixes to a problem that, if they had read history and studied the books, putting our soldiers on the ground over there wasn't a problem at the time we started putting them on the ground, because the North hadn't really come, they had come south, but they hadn't really come flowing south in massive quantities yet. And all they did is every time we put something in, they put something more in. And then we tried to surgically bomb the North. I mean, take out this little thing and take out that, but don't want to touch that, because that's, you know, I don't think we ever went for it for the juggler. And it's Sherman, when he marched to Atlanta, he's going to burn everything on the way, and that's if we're going to go to war and sacrifice, we need to go to war to sacrifice, and you know, from a soldier standpoint. And I think we've lost too many men and, you know, too many names on a wall.
You mentioned the importance of allowing dissension, basically.
Yeah.
The officers want to dissent, general officers in particular, but officers in general want to dissent, they should be allowed to, without fear of punishment, retribution. And of course, sometimes people just don't want to listen. Did you ever encounter that yourself as a Vietnam veteran, where maybe the subject of Vietnam was brought up in the company of other people, and it just became apparent people didn't want to hear about it?
Yeah, and I've heard military. Well, if they'd given us a free hand, we could have won the thing. And I don't believe that personally. I don't, the only free hand that they could have given us to win it is to, would have been to blow North Vietnam into the Dark Ages with atomic bombs or enough bombs. But we weren't, there was nothing that the military's hands weren't tied to the point that we could have won the South. Because it wasn't a military war we were fighting. It was a war of the, what the people wanted. And I don't personally believe the people wanted what they got in the South enough to stand up and fight for it. If they really wanted what they had deep enough in their hearts, they'd have fought strong enough for it to keep it. But I think Uncle Ho offered them just as much as the South did. From their standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
No. Did they know what Uncle Ho was going to do when he got over there and put him in re-education camps and things like that? I don't know. We supported Tito in Yugoslavia for all of many years, and he was a communist. And so I can't look at a person and say communism is wrong, because if you want the concept of communism, then that's your choice. I don't want it. But if you want it, and these other 10 guys want it with you, you can go out and have your little communist commune on it. That's okay, you know. And if y'all work equally and y'all share equally, then that's great. But the only thing wrong with communism was a couple of dictators that wanted to take in too much, and that's not part of communism. And I just think that Ho was not bent on taking Thailand or Burma into his realm of influence. And he wasn't going to side with China, because the Vietnamese had never sided with China in all their thousands of years of history. So what made us think that Ho was going to side with China? And I just think we got sucked into something that we didn't really belong in. And that's, I'm looking back on it now. I didn't have all those convictions up then.
Mm-hmm.
But as time went on, I got those things. And I've run across retired Air Force people and some retired Army. They just turned us loose, we could have won that thing. And I said, you know, turned us loose and we could have won it. I mean, well, we had a pretty free hand to go out and shoot up anything we wanted to shoot up. We weren't winning it when we were shooting it up. So, I don't know what else we'd have done. Taking more troops, I don't think the American people would have put up with it too much longer. There were just too many names already coming back, too many body bags. And we weren't showing any results. We couldn't show them any progress on a map or anything. Everything was the same, you know. And you're right that a lot of people don't want to talk about it. I find more people are willing to talk about it now than I did 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How has the war impacted you most personally? What's the most important personal experience or lesson you've taken away from it?
I guess the biggest impact of the war or the aftermath of it or whatever had on me is a more critical distrust of my government. I had before. You know, when I went in, what the Army did was right. Yes, sir, three bags full, we'll go out and get it. And now I sit back and I, when they talk about things, and I wonder if they're telling me the truth about the situation and whether this is critical enough for us to want to do. I guess that's, from a philosophy standpoint, that's the way it impacted me most. From a personal standpoint, I've had some bad times with people that I, friends that I lost, their loss, and trying to deal with people that don't understand what war is about. And I guess that came during Panama or one of those invasions down in Grenada or Panama. Some mother was on television raising hell about her little son that had gone and lost his leg. And her son didn't go in the Army to get shot at. Her son went in the Army to be all it could be and get a college education. And the concept of what an Army is about, and I think maybe our government doesn't know what it's about. We want to send them to be peacekeepers and policemen in Kosovo. And I look at some of those assignments and I said, the Army is about enforcing the foreign policy of the country. Enforcing it with force, killing and destroying something and being killed. And if we got to the point that we're all these humanitarian missions for the military, and I don't think that's what we want an Army for. I think we want an Army to protect our country against foreign or domestic, if that be the case, forces. And that Army is Navy and Air Force and Marines, whatever it is, has got to be a well-trained, well-oiled killing machine. Because that's what it's about. You don't win wars by patting people on the head and hoping things are going to be right. You've got to go out and enforce the thing. And when we lead the public to believe, join the Army, be all you can be, get an education, what mindset are you putting in the soldier that you're sending out to war then? Son, I want you to join the Army to protect your country, and your mission is to go kill people, and if necessary, die for your country. And that's the message we've got to be telling soldiers. And if we're not telling them that, we're not psychologically preparing them for what they're going to have to do, and not getting them ready, I don't think. But I get bitter sometimes at the way that the government has gradually began to treat veterans, and it bugs me. We got it down now. We guarantee every soldier three people at his coffin when we put him in the ground. Used to be we sent a firing squad, people to fold the flag, we'd send 10. 15 people to take care of the burial detail. Now, they get more sometimes, but if minimum, we give them 3. And then I turn around and I see a destroyer go out in the bay or somewhere out there with a whole naval complement to shove the coffin of a senator's son into the ocean, and he wasn't even in the service. And yet we can't afford to give the soldiers that fought and lost a leg or whatever he did a full burial detail. And yet Senator Sun can get a destroyer to take him and bury him at sea. And some of those things just just rankle me about what we gave up and where our country thinks that we ought to be with it. So maybe I'm bitter, I don't know. I just, not for myself. I had a good career. I came out alive. I got wounded, but I'm alive. I'm making it. And had good jobs. I'm retired. So, I'm happy. But I know others that are not as well off. And yet, I don't think we're doing what we should have done for some of those. And especially when we get around to bury them, and we want to short circuit the burial process. The guy wants a funeral, and we ought to ship the people from Fort Hood, Texas, all the way to Lubbock to bury him, if that's what it takes. And we're not doing that. We're taking some shortcuts. They're trying to do as good as they can because of the shortage of funds and money. But the country ought to do better by them, I think.
That's right. Do you think that the increased number of requests for burial details is contributing to that too? Because, of course, there's a lot of World War II veterans dying every day now.
Yeah. And they're
that's really stretching that burial detail thin.
Yeah, I mean, we're at that point.
Yeah.
And but those guys went to war in 42 and stayed there till 45 and really suffered and they deserve it. And they're part of the people that kept this world free and if we can't do something for them or do some little thing like that for us, where are we as talking about being a nation? And this latest thing in New York, It's brought a lot of the flags out and people starting to gel together a lot better. And maybe that's good. I mean, I hate to see that many people die to bring some patriotism back into the country. But I went to a grammar school, a dedication and cornerstone wearing ceremony they brought in the flag, half the teachers standing there with their hands at the side. The teachers don't even know enough to put their hand over the heart as the colors are moving past them. And singing the national anthem, same thing. The kids, most of the kids seem to, but half the teachers are just standing there, they don't know what to do. And I don't know, some of those things just sort of irritate me.
That's right.
Maybe they shouldn't, but they do.
Yeah. Are there any other veterans issues that you're concerned about? Things that the government isn't doing that it should be doing for its veterans, like health care, the Agent Orange issue, PTSD?
Southwest Asia syndrome or whatever it is, Agent Orange, they seem to have, the VA seems to have taken a more positive approach to that than they used to. The VA as a whole, the hospital system, and I use it, seems to have improved and gotten better than it used to be. I don't know whether that's a function of increased funding or reduced people utilizing the system, because as you say, the Second World War people are dying off now in quite large quantities. So maybe it's a system that there's less people using the system, and therefore there's more funds or more resources available. But the VA system seems to be on track, and we seem to have taken a better approach to that Southwest Asia or Southwest syndrome or whatever it was from the Gulf War than we did to Agent Orange. I mean, the Agent Orange didn't hurt anybody, blah 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 blah. You know, it was And that was a bald-faced lie. The government, you know, and we seem to have taken a better approach to the Gulf War syndrome than we did to Agent Orange. But I think the thing that bothers me is in the military now is we let it go to hell. Janice's daughter is in the military, and I visited her at Camp Drum. Mm-hmm. There's no it appears that there's no operation and maintenance budget for maintaining facilities at Camp Drum, because the facilities are just, rack and ruin. It's terrible. In fact, there was an article in the last Army Times about some congressional committee had flown around to half a dozen different bases and saw the fact that, the buildings aren't being maintained and all these things. Well, what happened is you ship people to Kosovo and you don't have that in your budget. You got to take it from somewhere. You take it from operation and maintenance first. You take it from training second, because that's the only two places you can take it from, essentially. So if you're taking them, if you're supporting the troops in Kosovo with this money, you're not doing any training, you're not maintaining your bases, so your living standards are going down, your training's going down, and that's not good. We've got divisions, her daughter was in the 10th Mountain Division. It's not a division. It only has two active brigades. The other brigade is in the National Guard. So we talk about how many divisions the United States Army has, but they don't have that many divisions at full strength. They're at 66% strength because they're missing a brigade. So if you call up the National Guard brigade and then ship the division, the next thing you call up to back them up is who? The brigade went with them. The National Guard have already gone with the first row of fighters. There's nobody left. We not only have we gutted the active duty, we've assigned the backup forces to be part of the active duty to go, and now we don't have a good follow-on force behind the first response. And that's the thing that bothers me from a political, military standpoint as far as what we're doing. I think we're getting ourselves in serious trouble.
Spreading ourselves too thin.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about this afternoon?
I don't guess so. Do you want to talk about something else?
No, I just want to make sure that we cover everything.
No, I've talked about everything I guess I know.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This will end the interview with Mr. Thomas Spencer.